Right, I think we can start. Thanks to everybody for coming to this another of the recent seminars of the Hellenic Observatory. It's a pleasure to introduce to you the speakers we have today. Apostolis Philippopoulos, on the very left, is a professor of economics at the Department of Economics at the University of at Athens University of Economics and Business. He has a BSc in economics from the National University of Athens, an MSc in economics from the Athens School of Economics and Business, and PhD in economics from Berber College here in London. He previously worked in the University of Essex. He's a research fellow at SESIFO in Munich and holds a regular visiting lecturer position at the University of Bern. He has published on a wide range of journals in macroeconomics, macroeconomic theory and policy. He's editor of Public Sector Economics and the Need for Reforms, published in the MIT Press, and co-author of a textbook on models of macroeconomic theory and policy. His co-author, immediately to my left, Dr. George Economidis, is currently Associate Professor of Economics at the Department of International and European Studies at the Athens University of Economics and Business. He has a BSc in International and European Economic Studies from the same university, an MSc in Economics from the University of York here in the UK, and a PhD in Economics, again, from the Athens University of Economics and Business. Former positions include visiting lecturer in economics at the University of Cyprus, and he's currently a research fellow at SESIFO in Munich as well. He has published also widely in academic journals in the area of macroeconomic theory and policy, and he recently acted as guest editor at the European Journal of Political Economy and SESIFO Economic Studies. We're going to have a presentation, I think, mainly from Apostolis Philippopoulos. The work they're going to be talking about is on economic growth in Greece, barriers and prospects. It is related to a project, as I'm sure you will hear, that has been funded or part-funded by the Hellenic Observatory. And we're waiting to hear not so much about the barriers, which in some way or another we're all familiar with, but the prospects, which remains the million-dollar question. We'll take questions at the second half of the seminar, so we'll allow the speakers to do the presentation in the first half. Without further ado, Apostoli, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. George and I would like, I will work from here. George and I would like to thank the Hellenic Observatory not only for the invitation today, the opportunity to present our work, but also for funding this project. So the paper I will present today is part of this project. So this is about barriers and prospects of growth. As you know, economists are miserable people and belong to this case, so I will talk more about the barriers than about the prospects. I was told that you are a mixed audience, so I will try to keep it, let's say, non-technical. I try to avoid presenting any equations, and I will present equations only if it's absolutely necessary, whatever it means. Let me start with motivating our work and what we do. I suppose most of those things are known to you already, but to justify what we do, I think it's necessary to go through those facts. So as you know, Greece has suffered a loss of at least one-fourth of GDP between 2009-2016. And this episode satisfies all the conditions of what Kehoe and Prescott have defined as a Great Depression. That is in terms of magnitude and in terms of persistence of the drop in GDP. There has been some recovery since the year 2017, but as we know, this is still fragile. Let me give you some fundamentals. The sentiments are better nowadays, but the fundamentals are still fragile or bad, if you want. Growth rates are less percent since 2017. Unemployment is still high at 17%. I think these are the latest data we have. Private investment is around 11% of GDP. Typically, it's around 20% in OECD countries, if I'm not wrong. Public debt is still very high, 175% of GDP. And also around 70% of public debt is owned by public institutions in the EU, okay, which is very important, I think. External debt, that is what is external debt, let me remind you, is the accumulation of current account deficits over time. It's still very high, extremely high, 140%, and we still have current account deficits. So the foreign debt is increasing, not decreasing. And also institutional quality is one of the poorest in the OECD and EU. By institutional quality, we typically mean, like, for instance, like people like Acemoglu, et cetera, protection of property rights, the rule of law, bureaucracy, corruption, things like that. I will come back to that because this is a rather important part of our work. So, it's imperative to restart the economy. This is standard. But before we search for engines of growth, we need to identify the barriers to growth. So what we want to do in this paper is to see which facts or which variables, if you want, can account for the loss in output, this one-fourth percent drop in GDP, and then building upon this to suggest some counterfactuals that can, let's say, can possibly lead to better outcomes. So we want first to identify the barriers to growth, the problems, if you want, and then building on this to suggest some remedies. Okay, so we work in three steps. Step A, we construct a medium-scale, micro-founded macro model of a small open economy and calibrate it to the Greek economy. As I said, don't worry about it. I will just go through I will just describe it in words and avoid presenting the equations. Step B, we'll feed the model. This model will feed the model with data from the year 2008, get a solution, and then depart from that solution. Okay, so departing from the solution in the year 2008, we will simulate the effects of exogenous drivers like, first of all, the adjustment program, what we call the economic adjustment program in Greece. And by adjustment program, and this is a rather important part of our work, I think, includes all those ingredients you can see there. So it includes the fiscal austerity, obviously, but it also includes the fiscal bailouts, the monetary accommodation, and structural reforms. This, I think, differentiates our work from most of the related literature, because if you read most of the models, including work we have done ourselves in the past, we pay more attention to the fiscal austerity. We have not paid any or very little attention, if you want, to the other side of the coin, which is the bailouts and the monetary policy accommodation. Those things are together. Let me remind you, because the fiscal austerity was the precondition for financial aid. Financial aid in the form of fiscal policy, the official bailout, and financial aid also from the point of view of the ECB, the monetary bailout, if I can call it this way. It's not politically correct, but it doesn't matter now. And also you have structural reforms, which means liberalization in product markets or labor markets. So this is what we mean by adjustment program, okay? And the other driver or exogenous force, if you want, because as I said in the beginning, we want to explain the loss in output. The other potential driving force of this loss is developments in institutional quality. I will come back to that in more detail in 5-10 minutes. So we set those things, those drivers, if you want, as in the data. That is, we set the fiscal policy variables as they are in the data, the time path. We set the fiscal bailout as in the data. I will become more clear about that in very shortly. We allow for monetary policy accommodation from the point of view of the ECB. We allow for some structural reforms, more or less as they are in the data. We also have data for institutional quality, so we feed those data into the model and simulate and see what we get. This is what we do. And then, as I said, we study some counterfactuals since 2009. This is what Vasilis, I suppose, meant before, that is things that could have done things better, possibly. Okay. So literature, it's a big literature. I'm not going to go through them, just to have a look if you want. These are papers which are, I don't know if the word is correct, but it's non-technical. It's policy reports and non-technical papers here. And here are some technical papers. By technical papers, I mean papers like ours, which are based on DSG models or dynamic models in general. Okay. So this is the latest paper. This is the latest paper I've seen. I haven't seen anything more recent than this. Okay, so before I present the data, if you want, and I describe the model, as you said, just let me remind you very briefly the timing of events. Okay, this, as I said, will help us to justify, to motivate what we do. So we had the meet from the mid-90s. I will be very brief here because these things are known. From the mid-90s to 2008, which was the last year before the crisis became obvious in Greece, we had the so-called euphoria years, euphoria period, but also by euphoria I mean high growth, okay? But we also have accumulation of imbalances. The imbalances are well known nowadays. We had budget deficits, pro-cyclical budget deficits, because the economy was growing, so this was destabilizing. Yes. We had pro-cyclical fiscal policies and also accumulation of public debt, naturally. We had very big current account deficits, and which means automatically an increase in external debt. And we also had poor institutional quality. I will show you the data in a second. Or low competitiveness, okay, real exchange rate appreciation. That was the problem of the single currency. So we had accumulation of imbalances like them. In 2009, we had what I think it's fair to call the best of the bubble. And I think these are the things that happened when we say best of the bubble. We had the sudden, in inverted commas, I think, the sudden realization of poor fundamentals, because it shouldn't be sudden. It was rather obvious, I suppose. The sudden realization of poor fundamentals. We had some negative news about public finance, that the budget deficit was higher than initially reported. We had some negative reports by the European Commission and rating agencies that made things worse. We had political polarization, institutional deterioration. This is institutional deterioration as in the data, sorry. And so we had all those things combined resulted in a confidence crisis reflected in sovereign premium. Okay? Greece was shut out from markets along with Portugal and Ireland, I think, yes? You correct me where I'm wrong. And we had the first bailout in 2010, plus liquidity from the ECB, excess liquidity from the ECB. I will come back in a second what we mean excess liquidity by the ECB. Then we had the depression years, 2009-16, some recovery from after 2017, as we said. But during those depression years, we had two more fiscal bailouts, more liquidity by the ECB. The precondition for financial aid, as we said, was fiscal austerity and further polarization, institutional deterioration, again, as recorded in the data. Okay, we said that. What is this? This is a typical international crisis. If we read any paper or book on international financial crisis, I think these are two are rather very educational, I think. The paper by Kourinkas and Obstral, and also, and especially the paper by Lorenzoni. We had that, the symptoms I just described are the symptoms of a typical international crisis, what we call international crisis. Poor fundamentals, a shock comes in, and then everything falls apart. Okay? Now, let me, because these are, as I said, that those will be the driving forces in our paper. We had three official fiscal bailouts in 2010, 12, 15, around that amount, which is huge, I suppose. And most of this bailout has been used to repay maturing government debt, interest payments, and bond exchanges. That it was not used to finance budget deficits at the time. Okay. And as a result of that, we have a change in sovereign debt ownership. This is what I mentioned before, but here are the data. Okay. This is the percentage of public debt, that it was owned by foreign private banks. Okay, as you can see, that was a peculiarity of the Greek public debt, because it was 70%, which means that only 25% in 2008, that was before the crisis, was owned, was in the hands of Greek, let's say, investors, Greek banks. Okay, most of it was foreign public debt. Okay, that played a big role, as we know, in the decision of the EU to help us. Okay, because it was bad for their banks. So 70%, and then as the crisis, when the crisis erupted, 2008-2009, this of course has been decreasing, and this is the official bailout. Okay, this is what is in the hands of EU institutions. The rest of it is in private investors in Greece, private banks, let's say. Okay, so those things should add up to 100, obviously. Okay, so this is by lambda EU, we mean, I repeat, the percentage of public debt which is the hand of public institutions in the EU. Pano, do you agree with that?
So this is about fiscal, let's say, bailout, if I can call it. Now, about the monetary policy, this is more complex, in my mind at least. This is more complex. Here are the measures taken by the ECB, not only for Greece, but for all those countries in need. Here are you can see a variety of measures which are not easy to model, in my mind at least. So you have full allotment policy, extension of maturity, relaxation of collateral standards, which is an indirect support to government bonds, of course, because those collaterals were government bonds, most of the time. We had the purchase of collateral government bonds themselves in secondary market through those programs. Okay, we had the announcement. That was not a real thing. It was just an announcement, the famous Draghi announcement that he will do whatever it takes to save the euro. And then we have, in the case of Greece, we had the ELA. Okay. And also have the so-called target 2 balances. What is target 2 balances? This is our liabilities and assets between national central banks participating in the euro system. Okay? And after hesitation, although Greece does not belong to this, we had the official QE of the ECB since 2015. Sorry, but I said this does not apply to Greece. This is a description of policies. If these policies are effective or not is another thing. I will try to come back to that if we have time. Okay, it's not so obvious. It's a debated issue in the literature. But first of all, let me explain you what is target 2 balances. Okay, because this is a rather controversial issue in the euro system. What is this? What is target 2 balances? These are assets and liabilities between, as I said, national central banks in the euro system. Obviously, if you look at the financial statements of the ECB, you cannot see targets. Why? Because these are cancelled out between countries. So if Greece has a target 2 liability, Germany has a target 2 asset. So at the level of the EU, this is zero. Okay? How it works? Here there are several papers or even books written on that, how target 2 balances work. I think in my mind at least, Zinn's book is rather polemic. It's not very neutral, I would say, at least. But the paper by Whelan is I think it's very useful. It's a paper published in Economic Policy in 2014, and it has several examples of how targets work between different countries. But this is an example taken from Whelan. Okay? So national central banks in Greece, etc., okay, increase loans or assets to their private banks and return to their private agents, because the banks were lending to the private agents, okay, by increasing their liabilities to the euro system. So you had an expansion of the national bank balances. In the opposite in Germany. Okay, because as I said, those things balance net out. Zero, becomes zero. Debate, if we read the ECB's, for instance, policy report,
they say that this is just an account, target two balances, and is just an accounting real-time system. So it's very innocent. If we look at the, for instance, colleagues in Germany, like Zinn,
then Zinn has called it the hidden bailout of the GIPS countries. Okay. If we look at the paper by Whelan, this is taken by his paper, if we look at the data, and I think also that implies a consensus somehow, this is what we see in the data. There is a strong positive relationship between national central banks lending and Target 2 liabilities. So Target 2 liabilities increased, and most of it, the correlation is 1-to-1, if I remember well, was going to finance loans to private banks, okay, which is also consistent with Zinn's stories. Target 2 liabilities financed capital flight to safety, okay, which is also Zinn's story. But there's no clear relationship between current account deficits and Target 2 liabilities. This is not Zinn's story. Because the argument by Zinn and German economists was that the Target 2 balances have been financing current account deficits in these countries. We don't see evidence for this, but we do see evidence for the other two. And here is something personally I like a lot. Is from, if I pronounce his name well, is Ethan. He's at the LSE. Is he still at the LSE? Anyway, I took that. It is in Whelan's paper. So this is what he has said, and I like this. I think it's very, very, very nice, very explanatory. Now, okay, maybe I took too much, but here are the data. I talk too much, but here are the data. These are the balance, the Target 2 balances. Now, I suppose you are wondering, why do we care about Target 2 balances? Because in the model, they play a crucial role. It's how monetary ECB has, let's say, supported countries like Greece. Okay, if we don't have that, we cannot close the model somehow. Okay, so it's the extra liquidity provided by the European Union. By the European Union, I include the ECB in the European Union. Okay, this is why I paid so much attention. So this is the target too. So it doesn't look to be so innocent, at least to me. This before the crisis, those were close to zero. But as you can see, after the crisis, we have an expansion, huge expansion. Okay, this is Germany assets. These are the GIEIB, how we call them, countries, which is liabilities. Okay. In the case of Greece, these are taken from the Bank of Greece, those numbers. These are total liabilities or total assets. Obviously, assets and liabilities are equal. Where is it? And here is Target 2 balances. As you can see, after the crisis, Target 2 liabilities are more than 50% of the total of total liabilities or total assets. Okay. And if we look at the numbers, for instance, for Ireland, it's pretty similar. In 2011, I think, which was the crisis year in Ireland, Target 2 liabilities were 91% of its GDP. Okay? So this is about financial role played by the ECB. And now let me go to the other part, if you want, of the economic adjustment program, which, as I said, is fiscal austerity. Here, obviously, there has been fiscal austerity, severe fiscal austerity in Greece. Here is total revenues as a share of GDP, and total expenditures, government, obviously. And so, as you can see, government expenditures were decreasing, where revenue were increasing substantially. And if we look at specific fiscal policy instruments, you can see also the same trend. This is the income tax rate. These are effective. This is the income tax rate. This is the consumption tax rate. These are effective tax rates. So they are constructed as in Mendoza and Tezar. So it's tax revenues divided by the tax base. Okay, this is the European Union calls those effective tax rates implicit tax rates, if I'm not wrong, but economists call them effective tax rates, but the same thing. Okay, so you can see the big increase in the income tax rate through the years, also the big increase in effective consumption tax rates. Now, in terms of spending,
That SW, I think, this is the share,
the intention GDP. Okay.
This is a public wages. This is the public wage bill.
As a share of what goes to public employees? As a share of GDP.
So this has remained rather stable or even increases, you can see.
Obviously, there is the denominator effect. The denominator goes down because of the recession. So,
but as a share, it has not decreased. It has increased over the years, as you can see, public wages. What has decreased is this is public investment.
All of them are as shares GDP. So public investment has fallen a lot, as you can see. Okay,
5.8 to 3.5.
Okay. But this is what governments always do. In periods of recession, they cut government investment.
And this is transfers. This is transfers, okay? This is transfers.
This also has not decreased over the years. Obviously, there's the denominator effect, but it has not decreased as a share of GDP. It has increased. So this is about fiscal austerity. And now about institutions. Before I present that, I will present some sub-indices. This is what we call the rule of law. The Greece is the blue line. You can see the picture here through the years. So Greece was had poor institutional quality even from the 2000s, as you can see. But the gap has increased during the crisis. And if you read people, for instance, like Papayoannou, Elias Papayoannou at LBS, he has written several papers on this, how the institutional gap, I think, as he calls it, okay, differences in the institutions, but those differences became more bigger, if you want, during the crisis. So this is the rule of law. This is the regulatory quality, which has to do with public sector efficiency somehow. Okay, not exactly, but it's a measure of public sector efficiency. Not surprisingly, this is law. If you live in Greece, this is not surprising. Okay, this is political, another index, what we call political stability and absence of violence terrorism. Okay, this is also very, very bad. Now, why do we concentrate on those two, on those three indices? Because these are the three indices that usually we use to construct an index of property rights. So usually in the literature, for instance, people like Acemoglu, etc., this is what we usually do. That is, we take the average, if you want, of those, the three sub-indices I presented before, and that gives us a measure of what we call property rights. So this is the degree of property rights in Greece.
Okay. Flexible.
Okay. Well. Okay, Vasil. Yeah. Okay. So. So fine. 10 minutes. Okay. So.
Plus more. A bit more. Yeah. 12.
Now 10 minutes. Okay. So we don't have time to go through the model even in words. But let me talk about it for a second and then go to the results.
Okay. So what we want to do here is to construct a model that includes, if you want, those characteristics. Okay. So the main building blocks of the model is we have households, obviously. Okay. But we have households, heterogeneous households, and we want to have heterogeneous households. Why? Because we want to have savers and lenders. And why do we want to have savers and lenders? Because we want to have different interest rates. Deposit interest rate, loan interest rate, risk premium, et cetera, et cetera. So to do that, we need some household heterogeneity, okay? So we have households which are heterogeneous. We have private firms, which are other standards in this literature. That is, we have final good firms, intermediate good firms, and capital good firms. This is rather standard in this literature. And intermediate good firms are
not perfectly competitive.
And why do we want to have imperfect competition? Because we want to have structural reforms. That is to see what happens when the product market is liberalized. So we want to have imperfect competition in some firms, at least. So we have firms, households, firms. What other type of firms we have? Since we want to have public employees, because
public employees is an important part of the Greek economy, we need to have state firms. So we have state firms, okay, and those state firms produce something called public output by using public employees, plus other inputs, but also public employees, okay? So this is about state firms. About fiscal policy, what we do, we have all those types of government spending and taxes I presented before, but we set most of them, almost all of them, as they are in the data. This is an important part of the paper, I think, of the model. Allow me to repeat that. We set all fiscal policy instruments, including public debt, and its decomposition to its value to its various quarters, the ones I presented before, the EU, foreign private markets, domestic private markets, etc., as they are in the data. What closes the government budget in Greece? Monetary policy accommodation, and in particular, target two balances. This is how we model the nexus, if you want, between fiscal and monetary policy. So it's a regime, what we call in economics, fiscal dominance or monetary accommodation. That is, monetary policy is adjusted so as to accommodate the fiscal policy. Okay? So it's a strong form of accommodative policy, monetary accommodative policy. This is what we do. Okay? If we do all those things, let me jump now. So you are lucky. You don't have to see that. Okay. This is basically what I said before, but... okay. Allow me to stay on this slide, because this is important, at least to those who do economics. Does monetary... I will ask a silly question. Does monetary policy matter? Does it have real effects? We know that we have to think of monetary policy in two levels, if you want. Okay, this is how we are trained. One is conventional monetary policy, which is interest rates, and the other is quantitative monetary policy, like the one target two balances, things like that. Do they matter? For interest rate policy to matter, it's well known. We need some nominal fixity. Okay. For quantitative policy to matter, does it matter? Well, in the profession, for many decades, we thought it didn't matter. Why? Because we used to follow Wallace's proposition. Neil Wallace wrote a paper in 1971 who said that it doesn't matter. The size and the composition of the balance sheet of the central bank does not matter. Okay. Because you have perfect substitutability, so it doesn't matter what the central bank does in terms of quantitative policy. This has changed since the crisis. Why? Because you know that those things have become, let's say, 4 or 5 or 6 times more. In Japan, maybe 10 times more. I don't remember. So to give a role to those policies, you have introduced some frictions in the model. Kiyotaki does those things, okay? John Moore, all those people do those things. But in addition, if we are in the currency union, even if we don't have those frictions, then quantitative monetary policies can matter. Who has talked about that? Please. Ricardo Ries. Okay, so basically the way we formalize monetary policy in this model, I think, is consistent, I hope is consistent with what Ries has done. Okay?
So given all this... It's good you have references to LSE people.
Yes, I have been very, very, very political. Yes. Okay. Okay, you don't need that. You don't need that. Okay, no, you don't need that either. Okay, maybe we do need that.
How we model Greek institutions? We model Greek institutions. We follow there's the classic work by Tallock. So there is a pie, a congestible pie, and then everybody tries to extract the share of this pie. How to do that? We allocate resources.
So this is what Murphy et al. Have called the misallocation of talent. So instead of, let's say, myself being productive, I try to rent sick. Okay, this is standard in this literature. This is what we do.
I think what we do, all the building blocks, maybe I said that before, I remember now.
All the building blocks are very standard. The only part which maybe is not so standard is the monetary thing. But I think it's consistent with this.
Okay, so we depart, so results. We depart from the 2008 solution. Transition dynamics are driven by exogenous variables. What are the exogenous variables? As we said in the beginning, austerity, fiscal bailout, monetary accommodation, property rights, institutional quality, and product market liberalization. These are the driving forces. So we fit the model, the time paths, with those exogenous variables and see how, if they can explain, if they can reproduce the depression. Okay? Okay, I said that. The model is deterministic, so we have perfect foresight. We have non-linear dynamics, so we repeat the same system of equations again and again in each time period. We solve it by using the Dinare toolbox.
Okay, we don't have, no, you mean something to trigger the shock in the, to trigger the crisis, you mean, in 2009?
With a decline in net capital
inflows. We can get that, but we don't need the shock because we had all those changes in exogenous variables, so somehow all those things can produce. It would be better to have a shock, we don't have a shock. Okay. But for instance, this, the deterioration institutional quality or the austerity are sufficient somehow to give us the falling output. You will see that here. Okay. So this is the results now. Results. Okay. This the black line is the data. Okay. And the blue line is the simulated path of output. I only present results for the output. Obviously, there are many endogenous variables. I just present the result for output. Okay. We have by 100. We mean that we start. Let's say these numbers here indicate the falling output relative to 2008. That is this number here, for instance, 78. It means what? It means that according to our model, in 2017, the falling output was 22%, 100 minus 78. These are the data. Okay, so as you can see, the model does relatively well to mimic the data somehow. We have the qualitative properties. We don't, of course, reproduce the full reduction in output. But we are pretty close, okay? We are pretty close. As I said, this is the difference between the data and the simulated path, okay? This is here. We try to decompose, as we said in the beginning, we try to decompose this output loss into its main drivers. This is the simulated path. This is what would have happened, that is the recession, the depression, however you want to call it, would be deeper if we didn't have the structural reforms. Because we did have some structural reforms in Greece, okay? So if we didn't have those reforms, the depression would be deeper, if you want. The yellow line, the dotted yellow line. This is what would have happened if we didn't have the institutional deterioration. That is, if you remember the data I presented before, in Greece we had poor institutional quality all the time, but that institutional quality became worse after 2008. So in this experiment here, we keep the institutional quality as it was in 2009. Not as it, for instance, it is in Germany, an ideal country, or Switzerland, or Norway, but as it was just before the crash in Greece. Okay, and as you can see, the fall would be much smaller. Okay, obviously this difference here has to do with what? With the fiscal austerity. Okay, this is the contribution of the fiscal austerity.
The opposite. Sorry. This has to do with the institutional deterioration.
This has to do with institutional, this has to do with fiscal austerity. Sorry, yes. Okay, you understand what George said? I hope so.
Okay. Here we have some counterfactuals now. What would have happened if we didn't have fiscal bailouts? Of course, there are many scenarios you can think about, okay, what would have happened.
In this particular scenario, what we assume is that this is the simulated path, okay, and this is what the counterfactual.
What would have happened if we didn't have the fiscal bailout? But what we assume here in particular is the following.
We suppose that instead of the fiscal bailouts, the debt or the deficit deficits were financed by an increase in income taxes. This is the scenario you have here. Okay? As you can see, it will be
dramatic. I mean, okay, but income tax rates are very distorting, obviously, so that makes it, the increase in income tax rates is big.
So I don't remember how, George, do you remember how big are those income tax rates?
It approaches 40-45%.
40-45, let's say, instead of 30-something, it's 40-something, 10 percentage points, let's say. But as you can see, the depression would be... much. We have experimented also with other scenarios
when you say no fiscal bailout, but the results qualitatively are like this, in the sense the depression would be much deeper. Okay. Less austere. Something, let me go back. This is the case without fiscal bailout. We have tried several, we have spent some time on this actually. As you can imagine, we have also tried to see what happens if we didn't have monetary bailout. That is, if the target two balance was zero. Okay? Non-surprisingly, we can't get a solution.
Okay, obviously. Okay,
the model does not deliver a stable solution. Okay, it's unstable. It's not feasible, if I can. If we take the model seriously, this is what it means. Less austerity, does it help? Does it help? Could less austerity help? This is the, as I said, the, as you said before, this is the baseline simulation. This is what would have happened. This line, dotted line, the gray dotted line is what would have happened if consumption tax rates were lowered by 2 percentage points than they are in the data. And this is what would have happened if the income tax rate would be lowered by 2 percentage points all the time. Okay, obviously the benefits would be stronger if we have a cut in income tax rates. Okay, so this is what happens with less austerity. And this in terms of lower taxes, and this is what would have happened with less austerity in terms of higher government spending. Again, it helps, but not so much as you can see. Okay? So this is the simulated always path, the blue line. This gray line is what would have happened if we have an increase in transfers by 2 percentage points, very close to the baseline, so it doesn't help a lot. This is what, yellow, what happened if we had, let's say, an increase in public wages by 2 percentage points. And this, the green and the red line is what would, which coincide, almost coincide, overlap, is what would have happened if we had public investment 2 percentage points higher than in the data, or what we call goods bought from the private sector by 2 percentage points higher. So yes, fiscal austerity in either in terms of, less fiscal austerity, either in terms of lower tax rates or in terms of higher government spending would help, but not by a lot, as you can see. And also, this is free lunch here. Why? Because all the time in this scenario with less austerity, I assume what? I assume that this is financed by the ECB, by target two balances. So it's like free lunch here, less austerity, but a free lunch
time. That sense is an upper bound estimate, like the optimistic scenario.
More credit provided by the ECB. More credit by the ECB.
But that means that in reality, it would be very difficult for more liquidity to be provided by the ECB, so that the effect would be dampened by that.
Exactly. The next slide.
Okay.
Now, this is not a free lunch here. It's not a free lunch. Here we have a fiscal policy mix. So what we assume here is that we have, it's written here. It's, here we have two scenarios, if you want. Here we have, it's something like a budget neutral change now, mix. That is, we have cuts in income taxes, but these are financed by cuts in transfers, or we have an increase in public investment financed again by cuts in transfers. So these are not free lunch scenario anymore, okay? So you spend more, but you cut another type of spending, okay? This is the idea. So that would help. But not so much, as you can see. More structural reforms, that is, we liberalize the product market here by changing the Dixit-Stiglitz parameter, okay, in the model the private firms, that would also help. So this is not the structural reforms we assume here are not that we become like Germany, but we cover some distance, some of the difference between Greece and Germany.
Here we become like Germany till 2012.
So we are Germany, and even that does not help. Okay, disaster. Nightmare.
Only like 3-4 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, don't worry. I will be done.
You don't slide
the
42.
Model, so it's,
yeah.
I skip the model. So here is, what is this, George? Here we combine all those things. We combine all those things, okay? So we have alternative fiscal policy mix, we have stronger structural reforms, we have pre-crisis institutions. In that case, the recession would be what? The falling output, the loss in output, sorry, with what? Would be 100 minus this, which is 9.5. This is very close to other countries, like Portugal and Spain. So what this picture tells us is that, let's say, what? If we have done things slightly better, not so much better, because the fiscal policy mix does not assume crazy things, let's say. And if institutional quality has just remained at its pre-crisis level, so we don't become Switzerland, we just have the same institutional quality as in 2008, not something spectacular. The loss in output would be something like 9%, which, as I said, is close to other countries, like Portugal, I think. Okay, possible extensions. Do you mean to go through that or stop? Vasily?
Move faster to the conclusions, if you don't mind.
Okay. Conclusions. So, Greece differs, asymmetries. We have asymmetries with other countries. This is a key issue, especially in a monetary union. We know that for many, many, many years. Fiscal consolidation was necessary. Why do we say that? Because we don't get a stable solution without fiscal consolidation in terms of stability. I mean dynamic stability. So it was necessary. Fiscal bailout, it helped to avoid a deeper depression. Monetary accommodation was particularly necessary. You don't get stability without target to balances in the picture, in the model. The depression on the other, these are the bad news if you want, the good news, the depression would have been much milder if here, when we say no fantasy world, we don't mean crazy, we don't make crazy assumptions, as we said, okay, it's light, it's little things. Institutions have not deteriorated since 2008. A different fiscal policy mix had been chosen. And structural reforms, especially in product markets and public sector, had been implemented. Okay. Thank you. I stop.
Thanks. Definitely a lot of material. We can take questions now. Please indicate interest in asking questions. Maybe we can take a couple of questions at a time, if you...
Whatever you prefer.
First question here.
I'm absolutely not an economist. I'm a complete layperson. So thank you very much. I didn't take in a huge amount there. But in the conclusions, very quickly, do you think lessons have been learned? You know, even just looking at the public sector wage percentage of GDP, looks like lessons haven't been, the obvious things, the things that just reading the press, people's perceptions of Greece. I actually grew up in Greece until I was as a child. You know, those sort of perceptions, those things that you pick up just being in Greece about what Greece is like. It looks from the bit of data I understood that lessons haven't been learned.
I have to agree, Bob. Some things. Let's say you have become wiser somehow, but not wise enough, I suppose. Okay, the public sector is a problem in the sense that it's very inefficient. However, not in terms of, let's say, anecdotal evidence, but also in terms of measurement. The public sector, for instance, there are people like Afonso, who is a Portuguese economist, who systematically has been, let's say, computing public measures of public sector efficiency for OECD countries in the last 20 years or so. Public sector efficiency has been low, and I think it has become even lower in, since the crisis, which is consistent with the other evidence on institutional quality in general. Because for countries like Greece, institutional quality and public sector efficiency are very highly correlated. Not in all countries, but countries at the top, that is countries, let's say, for instance, like Singapore or Switzerland or Norway, have very good institutional quality in general and high public sector efficiency. Countries at the bottom, like Greece, bottom in terms of OECD, because we have data only for those countries, they are also very highly correlated. That is, poor institutional quality, very low public sector efficiency. Countries in between, like UK or Germany, it's not so close correlated. Some countries have better institutions than public sector efficiency. But in Greece, it's a problem, yes. Here we use data for institutional quality. It's the time series. So the World Bank, for instance, publishes measures of institution property rights. So this is what we use. So as I said, we have the time path, we have those data, and we fit the model with those data. When we say counterfactual in terms of institutional quality, we don't follow the data, but we say what would have happened if institutional quality had remained from 2009 as it was in 2008.
Extreme political polarization.
This is the experiment we made. Okay.
Can I follow this a bit? So from the simulations, the effect of institutional quality is many times bigger than the effect of anything else that you...
Not many times, but it's the most important.
Yeah. And I don't know if I, you know, other Greeks in the audience have the same experience, but my impression is that institutional quality didn't really deteriorate that much. What may have happened a bit more is that people who participate in the qualitative part of the World Bank survey all of a sudden realized that Greece is not so good institutionally. So, you know, the index deteriorated more than the actual institutional quality in the country. So could that be a factor?
Probably, yes, you are right. I don't know. But probably you are right. But let's assume you are right. But this affects investment decisions, I suppose. So it is an important part of investment and consumption or capital flight. So it's important. Now, in terms of model, because I feel more, let's say, safe to talk about in terms of the model, that measure of institutional quality enters the so-called Euler equations, which means that it is a very important determinant of work, of investment, of all those things. Okay. Mm.
So it is not the magnitude itself; it's also how important it is in the model.
Those things are important in any model like this. Okay. Now, if those, but I suppose your point is not why this is so important in terms of the model. But your question is if this is a realistic measure, if you want, of institutional quality. We take it as it is in the data, okay? If you think, as I said, in terms of, okay, this is what investors look at, it makes sense to have such an impact.
I was wondering if you could
of private banks I didn't have time to even to mention. I actually forgot it completely. We do have banks here. We do have private banks here. And now the way we model them is as in Kurdia and Woodford, if you know that paper. So Woodford, I mean, there are several, let's say, branches in the literature. One is the Kiyotaki Gertler. The other is the Woodford Kurdia. So we model private banks as they are, or almost as they are, exactly as the, almost as they are in Kurdia and Woodford. So this provides the channel through which monetary policy affects the private, because private banks, I didn't have time to say that, but private firms borrow from private banks and private banks borrow from the national central bank. So we do have that link I mentioned before, that the target two balances increase the monetary base of the national central bank. This is translated into higher loans to private banks, and there's this loans to private banks are translated into loans to private firms.
And this channel is not disrupted in your model.
By what?
By the crisis.
Of course, yeah, of course. But yeah, it's part of the model. Yes, of course it's affected. Now, by how much, I don't know. But of course it is. It is. Yeah, of course. But I can't give you a quantitative answer now, how much that link, let's say, the role played by this link. But it is there.
Absolutely. Two things. First of all, the message that we have regarding structural reforms is a pretty pessimistic one. I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
Hold on a second.
What can I do?
Well, I have a little question of modeling here, in the sense that
yes,
you include in structural reforms only product market reforms, but the main reforms that were implemented in these years were primarily labor market reforms.
Yeah.
Also, there must be some kind of, several of the structural reforms, effectively, the eventual target is the improvement in institutional quality.
Sorry, say it again.
The eventual target of several structural reforms, I know that you are looking only at product market in your case, however, in a broader sense, several of the structural reforms, especially those that were related to the public sector, were primarily targeting improved institutional quality. Therefore, there is some part of the effect is covered by the institution. And the second thing that we have discussed several times. That
I have an answer to that.
Yeah, okay.
After many years.
Yes. I noticed that you were mentioning the main feature that affected, let's say, the Greek crisis was, let's say, this fear of Brexit.
This was
paralyzed everything.
About labor market reforms, as you can imagine, we have solved several types of this model. I have forgotten most of them now. But in one version, you also have the imperfect competition in labor markets. I don't remember now why you took it out, but as far as I remember, the quantitative results of that was very similar to product market. Okay, it's not a very satisfactory answer, but I can give you this superficial. Public sector reforms, no, we have left this out. It's very important, I agree with you. But here we model the public sector in a very innocent way, if you want. That is, we have public employees. They use it through a production function to produce a public good, and this public good provides utility and services to firms. This is how we have done. But we don't have any, let's say, stories about public sector efficiency, the public sector. We don't have that. So if you have institutional problem, this affects all sectors similarly somehow, including the public sector. Now, about the fear of Brexit, okay, that I think goes to Vasily. We have thought about it. First of all, in terms of modeling, we have played around to how to introduce this fear of Brexit thing. Like, for instance, the fear of Brexit. How do we model those things? We have tried somehow to include some tricks, let's say, to do some tricks to account for that. But I think, strictly speaking, the way to do that is to have, let's say, a model uncertainty. You remember, we have talked about that. Is if we had
The fear of Brexit means what? Or the fear of Brexit, if you want. It means that the model will be different. We don't know the model, how it will look like, let's say, if we leave the euro area. Or we don't know how Britain will be, let's say, after. We don't have historical evidence. So the way to model that, if we want to do that properly, is by using, Sargent's methodology, which is the robust control thing. But it's very messy. We don't know how to do that in a model like this. It's very complicated. But what I can give, I think your question is related to Vasilis, the data about institutional quality. Those data, as you correctly said, express a fear somehow. It's because some of those data on institutional quality are based on hard data, and some of them are based on perceptions. Okay? So perceptions obviously capture the fear of Greece.
Okay.
So maybe this is why they have so strong effect quantitatively. Maybe this is how,
as Vasily implied, that it's so
bad, so they go down so much after 2008. Maybe they capture this. Now, in terms of modeling, this is not satisfactory, but this is the way of how to interpret, I think, those results.
Can I?
Yeah,
you are right about what you said on labor market reforms. Actually, we read one of your studies in which you said that the main reforms that were adopted by Greek governments during this year were reforms in the labor market. This means that somehow the effect of these reforms has already taken into account in the simulated path of output. We assume that the labor market is flexible. And what has not been done adequately is product market reforms. So in this, in the experiments that Apostolis presented, what we want to show is what would have happened if product market reforms were stronger, because the effect of labor market reforms is already there in the actual and the simulated path of output.
Somehow.
Okay. Let me take more questions and then we, yeah? Are you satisfied? Okay, we had a question there, Tomas.
You talked quite a bit about the institutional quality and the importance of it, and it was very clear. Can you give us an example, moving forward, what really needs to change in the institutional quality for the country to improve the level?
Difficult question, but let me borrow what, for instance, Papaioannou has focused on in terms of institutional quality. He mentions the way that the courts, for instance, function. We have the most, let's say, the longest, the slowest
judicial
process, let's say, in Greece. It takes, let's how many days for a case to be. So this is, I suppose, one example of what should be done. To speed up to reduce the time.
Is that time for production or
no, for court?
No, it's time for a decision, for a court decision to be made, for a case to be judged. Because I think we have something like 600.
914.
But you're right, it's difficult to let's say, to suggest something which is...
In the particular indicator that you were using, it was the weighted average of these three sub-indicators. Some of them were almost automatically, as a result, let's say, of the end of the crisis and so on, we would anticipate almost automatically to improve. For several others, we need, let's say, far more effort and so on. Under normal circumstances, you wouldn't anticipate, let's say, more like this menu or anything like that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But what we see is the gap is also increasing relative to other countries. In all countries on the periphery of the Eurozone, the institutional quality has, let's say, decreased. The gap between the periphery of the Eurozone and the core of the periphery has become bigger after the crisis in terms of institutional quality, however you want to measure that institutional quality. Now, is it a result of austerity? I don't know. Obviously, they are correlated, those things.
Another question?
I'm looking at the model in the context of Ireland. If you look at what's the sort of aggregate data for Ireland, it looks like a huge success story. If you live in Ireland, you're not so sure. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the underlying reasons for the recent election results in Ireland. And the reason for that is the distribution. Well, it's a number of things. It's the data flows at the aggregate level don't really say what's happening at the household level. And in particular, there are distribution implications at different deciles. And that's even despite the fact that the Irish austerity actually cushioned the impact on lower income deciles far more, say, than UK austerity. I couldn't comment on Greek. So, and that's partly driven by what's happening to asset prices, and in particular housing costs and so on. And I just wonder, have you looked at what's happening to real household incomes? Because that, at the kind of ground, is the critical thing. And one knows from the Irish data that FDI flows really distort what's happening on the ground, kind of thing.
In terms of distribution here, okay, it is in the model, but I didn't present it at all. Why? Because we have those three types of households. If you remember,
yes.
We have what we call entrepreneurs, we have workers, and public employees. So we can calculate, we can compute. It's easy. We haven't done it here, but we can compute, let's say, developments not only in terms of GDP aggregate output, but in terms of incomes of those three groups.
Right, but in terms of income distribution, so you know, bottom quartile. Next
well, no, we have only those three types of households, and we don't. Okay, because we want to have, as I said, some heterogeneity, not only to study distribution, because this is not a serious model to study distribution issues. We need more structure. Okay, to be seen. But we have heterogeneity here for households only to get, if you want, different interest rates, different roles, etc., etc. But we can have measures of inequality, but only in terms of those three groups, not in terms
so
of...
So if you look at your at the aggregate level, you were showing a reduction of about 22% over the period. What is that if you just look at the household incomes?
I don't know. I can't tell you. I have to check it. I don't know now the answer to that. We can calculate that, but I don't know.
Okay, I'm not an
economist.
We're finishing with almost Mr. Buka, which is like politics, political economy, where we take the database with all the conditionality and what, in all countries, I mean, with the bailouts, and what was implemented and what was not. And we find that Greece is has implemented something like 75% of the conditionality, which only Ireland surpasses with the 90%. The figures are not exact because we're now working on the comparative chapter, which is the last one. This database was created by looking at the reports, but also at all the material that we have from the legislation, the interviews. So most of them are reforms that have to do with institutional improvement.
Mm-hmm.
Some puzzle. Either our database is completely wrong, or this data that the World Bank is and the other databases that you're using, the other that you're using are
the
tricky, or there's something going on there that we don't know yet.
The data you use, time. You get from the laws voted by the parliament?
So our data, we create the database by looking at everything that was written in the reports from the memorandum.
Because implementation in Greece is a different thing.
This is what we do. Okay. That's why I'm saying we're not economists, but we're public policy scholars. So we're looking at everything that has been written in the reports of the Troika, the legislation, the interviews, so saying if the legislation was implemented, media reports. So, like, there is a new public revenue authority, yeah? I mean, it's not only the legislation. We also look if the institution is there. And there is a lot of implementation in Greece. So it's like 75%, as it is also in Portugal, Cyprus, Spain. So the only country that is above is Ireland. So what? It's very different, you know? What I was trying not to speak, but I find it so different what you found. And yeah, we're finishing the book now. If it's wrong what we find, I need to know.
Too late.
Why?
It's not what we find, because we take the data as they are, mm-hmm, and we use those data in the model. What you do is something deeper somehow, in the sense you try to see if those data is, let's say, are realistic or not. I can't answer, but the answer I can give, a superficial one, is that several times, and let me be a bit, let's say, diplomatic here, we tick the box, mm-hmm, somehow.
Okay.
This is not true, obviously.
It's not true.
No, it is not.
But it is true. Even at the university where we work at, we know that sometimes we don't really do things, we just tick the box.
For several reasons, this is an example like the one that Stella was mentioning. Even in the reports where they were reporting that Greece is not implementing, etc., etc., whatever they were reporting that was not implemented, it was, let's say, something that was actions to be taken in the next review. And they were not implemented in a particular period, they were implemented later on. It is true what Yorgos mentioned, that initially, there was all these things that were producing the legislation, but we were not producing the circulars that were necessary in order to implement the legislation. However, even after the second review, they found out this thing. There are a few cases where there is no implementation. However, these are either things that were retracted by actions of parliament, pension reform, etc., etc., or there were another few cases where both the implementer and the final receiver of the reform was the public sector, the state as such. But there are not that many.
Okay. I'm not so optimistic. I say I agree more with you that I don't think those reforms have been made. But also something else which again is related. Those data, as we said, are not hard. The data we use here for those indices are not hard data. They are hard data, some of a part of it. The other is perceptions. Okay? So there are questionnaires. Do you feel safe as an investor? This is not hard data. This is feelings. This is the fear of Brexit or whatever.
Okay.
So maybe this is the. But this is the optimistic, I think. Personally, I'm sorry, Pano, but living in Greece, I don't think that all those reforms have been implemented.
Let me give you an example. You talked about the independent tax authority. Okay. On the one hand, we have the independent tax authority, the main task of which is to fight tax evasion. And on the other, we have members of the parliament who defend the right of specific social groups to tax evade.
Yes.
Okay, so where is the improvement in institutional quality when you treat all these things as a whole? Okay.
Okay. Can I... Okay, continue. Can I move a bit? We don't have much time, so can I add a question of mine and move to the part of the presentation which is about the prospects and stuff? I think, Apostoli, you did imply quite clearly that if we understand the barriers to growth, then we know how to generate more growth in the future. I would like you to discuss both within the confines of the model, in the sense of what else could change other than the parameters that you're looking at, but also more general, you know, from your experience of the Greek economy. Because at best, the things that got us here, you know, if we kind of fix those, then we're going to be where we were in 2008, 2006, whereas the objective would normally be to be in a better place, prospectively. So, like, taking as a given that, yes, we need to fix the problems, the barriers to growth of the past or during the crisis, what else would be the drivers to growth, you know, over and beyond the problems that you identify in the period of recession?
Okay, I mean, this is, there are some standard answers, I think. This is, we don't have to, let's say, to reinvent the wheel here, because there's a whole literature on growth literature, if you want. For instance, like the people I mentioned before, like Acemoglu, Jones, etc. And they distinguish between the layers of growth. That is, they have, for instance, they say, they ask some simple questions and they try to give some simple answers. I think this is related to your question, Vasily. That is, first they ask why some countries grow, let's say, more than others, obviously because they have factor accumulation. The human capital increases, physical capital increases, technology increases. But this is not a good enough answer because it's obvious. It's let's say, like an identity. The deeper question, and then we go to the second layer of growth, as we call it, is why some countries, if you want, enjoy factor accumulation. And then we have some characteristics of countries. If we look at the historical data, we have some characteristics of countries that grow. For instance, they have a good education system, they have competitive markets, they have infrastructure, they have things like that. This is the second layer of growth, as Acemoglu calls it. And then we ask again the same question, why some countries enjoy those features and some countries... And then the question goes to institutions. Okay, this is how we think as a profession in terms of growth. So I'm not saying anything new here because this is very standard. This is how we think, or wrongly or bad. This, so I personally can't say anything more than this, if you want. So it's all those factors, I mean, that... But that I think, those, let's say, classification, if you want, helps us to think in terms of causality. Okay.
Mm. Okay, but then just put it back to you as well. Institutions in the Acemoglu sense is not just the ease of doing business. It's like the deep institutions, which are very slow moving. So it's kind of culture. So then is... I wonder if there's something that we can learn from the model. Obviously, the model is very stylized, yes? But if there's something we can learn from the model, if you go on the second layer of things, so where do we, you know, like what are the doable things that mm-hmm. can get an acceleration mm-hmm. in the accumulation stage?
We haven't done in this model, but we have done in other papers, and people also have done it. I think what helps, maybe it's not so... I don't know if you agree, but it's what we call conditional aid. I believe that aid should be conditional. Aid, by mean by bailouts, all those things should be conditional. Conditional not on outcomes like budget deficits, but conditional on improvements in fundamentals, like, for instance, educational scores or property rights scores. Okay, that I think would help. To the extent, of course, that agents realize that. Okay, that is, you internalize, for instance, that you will get aid if, let's say, you improve that. So that would help. Okay, in terms of modeling, it would help. I think it also helps in the real world somehow. Conditional aid, okay, but not on outcomes, like the EU is doing, for instance, okay, to reduce your deficit by that. I mean, I don't think that helps.
Cohesion again, policy this is not
conditional
on...
But not, let's say, only on being poor, because the cohesion policy, if I understand, is you get, let's say, foreign aid, EU aid, structural fund, if you are poor. This is good to reduce inequality, but it's not so good for incentives. For incentives, you have to make conditional aid conditional on fundamentals like that. I think that would help.
Okay. Thank you very much. I sense there's no more questions, and it's a good time to stop the seminar. Before I ask you to thank the presenters and the authors of the paper, let me announce that if you haven't had enough of the questions by the front line here, our next seminar is in 2 weeks' time, I think, in the same room here. Professor Panos Tsakloglou will be presenting on distributional changes in turbulent times in Greece, which also touches upon a question we had earlier about the distributional aspect of the crisis. So Tuesday, 10th of March, I think it's 2 weeks' time, here, our next seminar. Okay, thank you all for attending the seminar, and please join me in thanking the speakers.